Session number 4891, reel 6.
Newsreel cameraman, Jim Wright, reel 6.
Well, as I, as you've seen from the letter that I have from General Aker, who was the commanding general of the 8th Air Force, I did 31 raids with the 8th Air Force, but I have not found out what happened to all the film I did, because on every raid I went, I shot film, but I have not seen all the film I shot. I would very much like to know what happened to some of it. It may have been that it was considered to be too chancy to show, or I don't know whether that's the right word. It may have not been politic for them to show certain places that were bombed. I know that there were many places that were laid down by the authorities that should not be bombed during the war. You may not know that, but I know it. And as the 30 years have passed, you've told me an Official Secrets Act, I can tell you that a certain aluminium factory outside Paris was an absolute forbidden to go anywhere near it with a bomber. Don't ask me why, I don't know, but I know it was fact. There were a number of places that were not allowed to bomb. There must be very good reasons for it, but I don't know what they are.
Did one raid differ from another from the filming point of view?
Yes, some were. Some was what is what the American, what the RAF used to say, is a piece of cake. Others were just plain bloody hell. It depended. I remember one particular raid in which 400 bombers took place. We took off from Bazimbourne, flew out into the North Sea. We milled around over the North Sea for Christ knows how long, formating, until we got the whole 400 into some sort of regular form and fashion. We flew right up the North Sea, right up almost as far as Skagerrak. And it was a beautiful day, beautiful, beautiful weather. You could see the whole coast of Norway in the distance. All the fjords and everything. It was a beautiful, gorgeous sight. Then we flew all the way back again, right the way down, through the Straits of Gibraltar. No, through the Straits of Dover. What am I talking about, Straits of Gibraltar? Straits of Dover. Until I thought, well, where the hell are we going? And then we turned round, went back again up the North Sea, and then suddenly we turned east. And we bombed Wilhelmshaven. And from the time we took off to the time we landed back at Bazimbourne, we were in the air for 11 hours, which I thought was totally unnecessary. That's my thinking, but of course it's nothing to do with me. I mean, it seemed an awful long time to fly before you went on a short sea trip. I'm afraid I'm of a breed that believes in going straight out, like you do with the rugger balls. Get right in the middle of it and quick, get it over with. But that was hell. We suffered more frostbite on that particular raid, on a short journey across the North Sea to Wilhelmshaven. I think more people suffered frostbite on that than in all the raids I went on. And with my God, we lost a lot of men. Or when I say lost a lot of men, we lost a lot of fingers, because quite a lot of air crew would have their fingers amputated after a raid because of the frostbite, which was greatly prevalent in those days. Don't forget, these aircraft were all open to the elements.
Did the intense cold at these high altitudes affect your filming in any way?
Not unduly. As I explained previously, that the camera was completely devoid of grease, and the chief trouble was, of course, me, the operator. The intense cold, it's so cold, the moment you open, and you're sitting over an open hatch, you've got the complete draft of an aircraft at high speed coming up into your face. Of course, I was clothed in complete rig out of clothing. The American had very fine heated clothing, consisted of a suit of long johns, what looked like long johns, a sort of blue flannel, with heater wires running right the way through. We had boots which were electrically heated, or shoes at least, overshoes, and then we put those into fur-lined boots. We then, over the top of that, we had a very thick fur-lined leather suit, and which consisted of trousers plus and then a jacket. And then, of course, all this was wired so that you could put your gloves on, and you had electrically heated gloves. I'm afraid if I hadn't have had electrically heated gloves, I might have had more damage to my hands than I've got now. This is all a result of frostbite and old age now. It's all come out. And unfortunately for me, I had to take my gloves off every time I wanted to change a lens. Or if I wanted to put a new magazine in the camera, I couldn't do it with gloves on. I just had to grin and bear it and have everything more or less ready to whip open the side of the camera and whip a new magazine in. It's very that's the beauty of the camera I was using, which I've explained to you before. Very easy to load, very quickly. The loop was already made on the magazine, so all I had to do was open the gate, slip the magazine into the camera, put the film through the gate, make certain you had the right distance, top and bottom of the gate, and you were loaded. All I had to do was shut the camera and press the button and start shooting again. As a matter of fact, with a bit of practice, you could do that in a matter of 20, 30 seconds, 40 seconds at the most. It depends on how cold you are, whether you drop anything.
But for a normal bum run, you wouldn't need to reload the camera, would you?
No, but you have that already loaded. But I mean, if you wanted to change your lens or change a magazine, put a new magazine in, assuming that you had perhaps two targets to cover, then of course you had the problem of changing. Under normal circumstances, one magazine would have done all the lot. Well, then, as soon as we finished a bombing run, and I'd got secured the pictures of the actual bombing itself, I then had to get out of the hatch, unhook myself from the electrical circuits, provided me the heat and the oxygen, by the way, because you've got both things, you've got oxygen and heat. I then had to get a walk around, what they call a walk around oxygen bottle, as you stick into the side here and hook that onto the face mask, because you see, you can't live very long that height without oxygen. And having got all that, got the camera out and closed the hatch, I used to then go into the main bottle of the fuselage, that's through the doorway, past the ball turret, into where the two waste gunners were situated. And I used to leave a bag, what they call a heater bag, which was a large canvas bag, electrically heated. That would be already plugged into the ship's electrical circuit. So when I got there, these were Kodak 60mm cameras. It's called Kodak Specials in those days. And to have four of those loaded with 60mm film. And the idea was that when the waste gunners were working, if we were being attacked, and they would be working like madmen, you know, guarding the plane. So I'd take pictures of them, you know, working the gun, and once or twice try and take pictures of the attacking aircraft. Unfortunately, this is 60mm, and some of it was blown up into 35mm, but some of the material that I shot, I've never saw the light of day. I don't know what happened to it, because it was all turned over to the Americans, and I'm afraid that quite a lot of it was sent direct to America.
And you not have used your Aikley camera?
I couldn't use the Aikley camera. An Aikley camera is a camera that you can only use on a tripod or on a mountain. It's not a hand camera. It's a stand camera. And you can only use... a DeVry is not a very suitable camera. With a DeVry, I tried a DeVry. I had a DeVry, actually. In fact, I've just sold it to Samuelson's. They've got it in their museum. The De Vry I found was an unsatisfactory camera that, even although I took all the grease out of the mechanism and washed it out so it's completely dry, it would only run for about 30 feet at that in that intense cold before it stopped, slow up and stop. So it was a very, very unsatisfactory camera because you couldn't put a De Vry, too big a camera, in a heater bag because I'm afraid it would get too hot and have a tendency to, I don't know, sweat or do something, but I tried it once and it wasn't satisfactory, so I gave up the idea of trying to take pictures with a De Vry. I took a few pictures with a De Vry, but I could only shoot 30 feet at a time, and that's hardly enough to really impress me anyhow, 30 feet of film, and then rewind to get the full strength of the spring in order to get it run another 30 feet. By that time, by the time I'd got it wound up for another 30 feet, any action that was going is over, because I can assure you an air attack lasts for split seconds. A thing boring in at you at a rate of knots. I don't know how fast the missile slits were flying. But it was well over 250 miles an hour, and we're flying at one speed. While you're meeting on like that, you can imagine the combined speed is so great that they flash past you like that. It's very difficult to shoot. Most of these contrived shots you see in big films are definitely contrived in order to get that sort of effect. They're done with speeded up cameras so as to get more film in.
Were you often attacked by fighters?
I think so, yes. I should say almost every raid, or nearly every raid. I can only think about two raids where we were lucky enough to avoid them. But I think most raids you go on, you could always guarantee that Jerry would come up and have a go. Well, that was their job anyhow.
Would they tend to go for the lead ship?
They go for the lot, go for anything. I mean, they took them a little time to work out the what I call the blind spot on a B-17. The blind spots on a B-17, as everybody now knows, is 11 o'clock and 1 o'clock. And you see, the bomb aimer in the front compartment, the bomb aiming compartment, only had two guns, a 30mm and a half-inch gun. And he couldn't swing those round sideways, otherwise he'd hit the props. The radio gunner, or the gunner working from the radio compartment, couldn't depress his guns down, because if he was doing a pan with a gun, he'd shoot the tips off the prop again. So it didn't take the Germans long to realize that the soft spot on the B-17 was a head-on attack. Actually, at 12 noon, head-on, as fast as you'd come. And they would come steaming at you that way and then dive right underneath you. And which meant that the time they went down, they were going so damn fast, even the ball turret gunner underneath you had very little time to reach them, because by this time the going away speed was in excess of 600 miles an hour, I think. A tail gunner, of course, had no chance at all, and the waist gunners couldn't deflect down to that extent. So They gave up attacking towards the side of the aircraft. They would go for the tail because they only got the tail gunner to deal with. No other gun in the B-17 can cope with a head-on tail attack. You know what I mean? Straight at the tail. So, and no camera could get into the tail with the gunner there. There's no room. So That wasn't a very comfortable position in the aircraft, anyhow.
Did you ever use colour film?
Only in the 16mm film, and I never saw any of it, so I feel that quite a lot of it must have been sent direct to America, and I don't know why.
So the Kodak specials
always... They were all colour film.
Always?
There's always colour film. And one or two pictures that were used from the 16mm were blown up to 35mm.
In colour or...?
No, from colour to black and white. You can do make a black and white from colour film. You can't make a colour film from a black and white. That's all. A black and white from a colour film is not very satisfactory. You've probably seen enough of it yourself to know that. But it can be done.
Did your lens ever ice over? You described how the camera itself...
No, the only time I had trouble with icing was at Ham. And I don't know why I didn't get it after that. Unless it was because I probably didn't point my camera forward as much as I did before. I used to like shooting bombs, leaving the aircraft and following them down. Well, after Ham, I realised that having the lens pointing forward, because I had to point forward to show the bombs leaving the bomb bay, meant that the cold air was rushing in. And if there was any moisture in the air, or cloud formation or anything, that would naturally cause icing. But if you kept the lens down, it didn't seem to ice up. So I waited until the bombs were away and then followed them, you know, as soon as they were dropping straight down. Because they tumble a bit when a bomb first releases, and therefore it starts going on a straight trajectory downwards.
From Bassingbourne, you moved on to Earlscombe to film From the Rorders.
Yes.
Could you describe the first raid?
The first raid I did with them was rather a hectic one over Calais. That was slightly different to the run-of-the-mill B-17 run, because the Marauder is a sort of fighter bomber. So it gets thrown about the sky quite a lot more than you can throw a bomber around. So I was more or less in my element there, but of course it's not very conducive to good filming. When an aircraft is being thrown around a lot, it doesn't give a cameraman much chance to get anything. I did get some good shots. At least I was told that they were very good shots over Calais. It was rather a hectic do. There was a good deal of anti-aircraft fire, and there was a good deal of fighter problems to deal with.
Where were you positioned in the plane?
I used to work from the waist position, shooting through the floor, or shooting through one of the side positions. There was a waist gunner's position. I'd shoot through the side there. But you see, the point is there, you're stuck on one side of the aircraft and you might be on the wrong side when something is happening. You can't get across the other side in time to get it. Everything happens so quick in the air, as any pilot will tell you. You've got to be very lucky to get anything. Anyhow...
Were you still using the Akeley?
No. Yes. In the floor position, I used the Akeley. Yes, of course I did. But I was trying to work the Devry more in the Marauder, because it was slightly warmer in the Marauder than it was in the B-17. B-17 is a very cold aircraft. In any case, we weren't flying so high. The highest we ever went in a Marauder was 19,000. And if you went below 14,000, or even from 10,000 downwards, a Marauder is very vulnerable in wartime, because it's a very fast aircraft. It's quite a big bomber. Although they call it a fighter bomber, it's a big aircraft, and it's a considerable effort to throw it around, twin engine job, and that sort of thing. If you're going to throw an aircraft around, you want a bit of space to maneuver in. When you've got a sky full of other Marauders and German fighters, it doesn't give you an awful lot of elbow room, does it? I covered a number of raids along the north coast of France, raids on trains, you know, German troop-carrying trains, one on a forest, which we were told housed the entrance to the tremendous underground telephone exchange the Germans had built, making a complete network of their whole of their aircraft installations in the northern coast of France. I can't think of the other places. There were 13 of them altogether. I covered 13.
What did you do after that?
Well, by this time I was getting a little weary of all this hectic life, and I had a break back in the office for a while, just to more or less get my breath back. And I was then asked if I would like to go out to North Africa as a bit of a change. I said, doing what? They said, oh, well, the 12th Air Force could do with somebody to help them. And I went out to General Spatz, 12th Air Force.
Who had replaced you as news editor? Or was
A man named Partington. Fred Partington, who was my assistant. He was assistant news editor. He took my job over. There was nothing to do anyhow, because everything was, by this time, rota, everything was sort of a handout, what we call a handout, from somebody or other. So, I mean, no point in sitting there. I'm not that type of fellow to sit down a sort of static job. I like action. That's what you've probably gathered by now. But I said, yes, it'd be rather nice to have a summer holiday in Northern Africa. I rather fancy it. I didn't realize what I was letting myself in for. However, I went out to North Africa. Rather tedious journey. It meant going up to Prestwick and flying out of Prestwick at night time, right down the center of the Atlantic, coming into Casablanca. Rabat Salah. I'm not certain whether it was Casablanca or Rabat Salah. And then from there up to Algiers. And then from Algiers I was taken by road to a place called Chateau Dun, where the aerodrome, where the Americans had fixed their aerodrome, one of their aerodromes.
You were exclusively in contact at this time with the Americans, or did you come into contact with the British?
No, I was with the Americans. I was still working with the Americans. The Air Ministry still didn't want to use me. I wanted to fly with the British. I was a British airline. I wanted to fly, but they wouldn't hear of it. Not that time. That was a bit too early in the war. Later on, of course, when I was in Italy, I heard that they'd taken all sorts of scribes over Berlin. All sorts of people had got trips in aircraft. Almost anybody could get a trip in a bomber if you knew the right person at the Air Ministry. And there I was, sweating my guts out with the Fifth Army, slogging along with the Fifth Army up the Italian peninsula. I gave up the flying game after my term with Chateau Dun.
That was after 48 raids.
Well, I did 48 altogether. That's including what I did at Basingbourne and Elskern, and then the raids at Chateau Dun. There wasn't an awful lot to do. I had a raid at Palermo, raids in Sicily, a raid on the railway station in Naples. We bombed the railway station at Naples. I don't know what for, but I suppose to disrail or disorganize this traffic. And then I was recalled to England.
Being an extra member of the crew on a plane, did this not cause problems ever over the weight of the thing?
No, they accommodated me, because normally I think they were getting a bit short of air crews, and they just found me an aircraft where they only had one waste gunner instead of two.
and you were...
So I just take one side, I take the other. Well, if he was on one side, I couldn't very well swing over to his side. So that's why I found it very, except for just bombing. But we didn't get an awful lot of attacks down in the Mediterranean by this time. I think I only saw a German aircraft the whole time there. I mean, that really was a holiday. Plenty of anti-aircraft fire, but I mean, what the hell's that? I only saw one German aircraft the whole time. So it was a holiday. They told me it was a holiday. That was the idea of just sending me out there, I think. However, I got fed up with it and I went back to England again. And no sooner I got back, said, well, would you like to go to Mark Clark's outfit and try that for a while? So I said, well, I thought a bit of a risk would do, and I didn't know what the hell was going to happen. So anyhow, I agreed to go, and that was it. I went out. I was properly accredited to the Fifth Army. I showed you a card, my accreditation card, thumbprinted and whatnot. The only time I've ever been thumbprinted was done by the Fifth Army. Oh, I had a very good time there. Rather rough and ready. I don't like foot slogging, by no means. Although the Americans don't do much foot slogging, it's mostly jeeping. They were very good. They were excellent, most cooperative. Gave me a jeep any time I wanted it. And a driver, take me anywhere I wanted to go. I covered a number of things going. There's not much you can do in modern warfare these days. There's no trench warfare. It's not like the First World War, no trenches or anything like that. In fact, you'd have to look very hard and find the troops. They might be stuck here and there, a couple in one foxhole, a couple somewhere else in another foxhole. It doesn't make good pictures. One thing called to mind, I was at a briefing once, and they said, oh, we're going to get a very good tank battle in the Leary Valley. So I said, well, how the devil do you think I'm going to get a tank battle? Unless somebody give me a Piper Cub, and I'll fly over it and film it from the air. They said, oh, no, we can't do that. But somebody looked at a map and they said, oh, well, look, there's a mount called Mount Lungo. If you get up on Mount Lungo, that overlooks the Leary and this valley, this plain, Leary Plain, I think it's called something, and you'll be able to see the whole of the American tanks advancing towards the German tanks. You'll see the Tigers and the American Shermans, or whatever it was, the Germans. I don't know what the Americans were using, anyhow. I don't know the first thing about tanks. But you'll get a good shot there. Well, I climbed this damn Lungo, Mount Lungo, Long Highway 6, that I do remember. And sitting there quietly, waiting for a tank battle to start, and all of a sudden, not very far from me, there was a colossal explosion, which, from experience, led me to believe it was an 88, German 88. I didn't like that one little bit. I didn't know where it came from. And I thought, well, this is not a healthy place to be. And I suppose I must have been noticed. Somebody's got some pretty powerful binoculars somewhere. Seen somebody sitting on Mount Lungo. They probably think I'm an OP post, or what do they call it, observation post. And they flung this thing at me. And I thought, well, that's not so hot. So I moved slightly and got behind an outcrop of rock on this Mount Lungo and waited for this mammoth tank battle that I'd been promised. And all that happened, I saw two American tanks just go and ditch themselves through running off the road into a ditch and turn sideways, and they became, you know, useless. Couldn't get out of the ditch. So as I was moving from this position, thinking, well, I'd better go down and see if I can get something nearer, find out from somebody what's happening about this so-called tank battle, I fell some little distance down the side of Mount Lungo, and I didn't break my ankle, but I did an awful lot of damage to it, enough to put me into the hospital at Caserta for about a week while it got better. It's a very, very bad strain. I thought I had broken it at the time, That put me out of action for a whole week at least. And then, this time I got over that, I had another bad fall somewhere, I forget where it was, and they sent me then to the General Hospital in Naples, overlooking Naples Harbour. And all I saw, lying in the hospital, saw the Liberty ships being bombed by one night. It was quite a pyrotechnic display. And of course, lying there watching all this and not having a camera was very irksome. However, I did film quite a lot. I had a lot to do with filming Monte Cassino, just before the attack on Monte Cassino. I had made quite a number of films here and there. I was the first war correspondent to enter the town of Cassino.